Jeremy Wade, who's really just one of the coolest guys ever to pull on a fishing line. I mean, if you've ever seen the movie River Monsters, it's sort of like, I don't like, it's like, he's like, it's like James Bond meets Babe Winkleman, if you can put that together in your mind. It is the most treacherous, extreme fishing show. And the river monsters that he finds and the river monsters that he pursues are the theme of both the new book about river monsters and the first and second season out on DVD. We'll talk with Jeremy Wade coming up next, and we'll find out about the ones he's caught and the ones that have gotten away, like the Amazonian Nessie, which we've linked up at coasttocoastam.com. You can go take a look at some of those river monsters that Jeremy Wade has been pursuing and has yet to catch. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Ponet. Well, it occurred to me, actually, that I'm not sure that Jeremy Wade knows who Babe Winkleman is. So let me just assure you, Jeremy Wade, it's a cool thing to say you're kind of a combination of James Bond and Babe Winkleman, just so you know. And thanks for joining us tonight on Coast to Coast.
Hello, yes. Can you hear me all right?
I think I can hear you okay. Sounds a little muddled, but I think we can get through. I hope we can anyway. And I mean, I know you've heard this pun a million times, but it's true. After about 5 minutes of watching River Monsters, you get hooked. You just can't help it. And partly because it's not just that you do it so well in pursuing these fish. It's just that you actually do catch these things, or at least you have a pretty good batting average.
Absolutely. There's always pressure because the shoots aren't that long. They're a couple of weeks, and sometimes a bit of desperation creeps in, which does, I think, translate onto the screen. But yeah, I mean, they have been described almost as cryptozoology programs where you're looking for something like the Yeti or the Loch Ness Monster, but we actually produce it in the end and show everybody what we've been talking about.
Yeah, and they're dangerous things too. It's not like you're just trying to get a photograph of it. You actually catch it usually, and these are freshwater, by and large, freshwater fish, eels, creatures that live in the water. But how many of the ones that you catch, Jeremy Wade, how many of them do you think actually could kill somebody?
Well, a very high percentage. But the thing is, we're normally talking about potential. These things aren't sort of cutting a swathe through the human race. It's a case of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And although the programs can get people a little bit scared, I mean, one of the other aims of what we do is they are about fear. These things are quite fearsome. A lot of them, something like the Goliath tigerfish, which is a bit like a piranha scaled up almost to the size of a person. I mean, that can bite lumps out of people, several pounds in weight, a 6-pound lump of meat out of your leg or wherever.
Right.
But
right.
The chances of that happening are very slight. And if you understand it, if you know its behavior, then you can minimize those chances.
But even still, when you go on these remote places on the planet, you and I think, I don't know how many of your shows I've seen, but a lot of them, and in almost every program, and I really like the way you approach things anthropologically. You're not there to fix the thing. There's no great white fatherism, just because you're there. You go in and you kind of live with them and in their circumstance. And there are a lot of people who tell you stories about how kids are missing. Families, are still grieving over the loss of people to these fish that are not sharks, that are not well-known predators, but they still do occasionally take people into the river.
That's right. I mean, the shows very much do start with the local populations. I suppose, in a way, most of the programs start with a fisherman's story, and in the minds of most people, fishermen are very prone to make things up and exaggerate, and in certain parts of the world, people might be a bit embarrassed to tell you what they've seen or what they've heard. But because I'm a fisherman as well, and I spend time with them and we have shared interests. They possibly tell me things that they wouldn't tell somebody who's an anthropologist or a normal reporter or whatever. We have that shared interest in fish. And I think the other thing to say is that fishing rivers tend to be a bit of a minority interest in say, North America and Europe. You go somewhere like the Congo or the Amazon and people's lives very much revolve around the river. They get their food from it. And so it's something that is a real, my interest in fish is a real point of contact with people. And so we start off getting the story from people, but then they are the ones with the local knowledge. They are the ones who are going to help me to track it down. If I just came in and insulated myself from people, I wouldn't get very far.
No, but you do that really well, and not everybody also. There's a reason why River Monsters is I think it's the most popular show on Animal Planet, isn't it?
Yes.
And you deserve that because it's a really well done adventure in every program as you go down or up these rivers. And I think that's the difference. I think there's something about the idea that it's fresh water as opposed to salt water, because we associate salt water monsters. We think about, you know, all the sharks and all the giant squid and all this stuff. But fresh water, somehow in our minds, we're thinking we're safe, that there's no way there's something that weighs 500 pounds in a river, but they're out there.
Exactly. And I think, yes, that is definitely one of the elements, one of the things that's got people interested. Fresh water is uncomfortably close to home, or it can be, even though a lot of the programs I do are in places like, the Amazon, the Congo, whatever. I did one program in the first season on alligator gar, and this is like it's like a crocodile with fins, and its last stronghold on the earth is actually in Texas. There are fish 200-300 pounds, 7-8 feet long, swimming around very, very close to big centers of habitation in the world's most industrialized nation. And some people know that who live there, but a lot of people don't.
Right. The alligator gar being coming from the old German word for spear. It's the same word that gives us garrison and so people, they don't even realize that if you actually look, you can go online and you can look up alligator gar, and it looks a lot more like an alligator than it does a fish that you would expect in a fresh water.
I think the other thing about fresh water, it's quite looking now with hindsight on why people are sort of enjoying the program. I think the thing about freshwater is you can't, as a rule, see into it. It tends to be quite muddy. The sea is clear water, so you can make a traditional wildlife program about the sea. You can send somebody in the water with an underwater camera, and they can film things.
And
as a result, we know an awful lot about what lives in the sea. We know about what lives on coral reefs. We even know what lives down in the deep oceanic trenches. We know about the giant whales. But freshwater, the general state of knowledge is very low, because you can't, there aren't nice picture books about what lives, of underwater shots of what lives in the rivers, because your visibility is very often 0 or 6 inches or something like that. So in the programs, It starts off with a story. You get a picture in your mind. It's a mental picture, which is often quite unbelievable. Surely these people are making it up. And in the end, normally, not always, but normally, the only way that I can find out what is there is by putting a fishing line in the water and seeing what I can pull out. It's not really a fishing show, but that is my method generally of getting to see what it is that people have been talking about.
Well, it's like the coolest fishing show on television. It's not a fishing show. It's the way all fishing shows should be, as far as I'm concerned, because I've watched a few fishing shows in my life, and most of them are very oriented around the sponsor of the show, about the outdoor. It's about the outboard motor or about the pole or about something. And what yours is really about, and what I really love about it, is just what you're talking about, that murkiness of the river. You can't just stick a camera down there and have something swim by it. You've got to go find it, or it has to find you. And those are some cases it comes and finds you.
That's right. Sometimes I'm the bait. When I was looking for in the most recent season, there's something which Captain Cook described when he went to New Zealand. Somebody told him about these 8-foot-long creatures that are a bit snake-like, they're a bit lizard-like. They're said to devour people, and you read that journal and you think, well, what can that be? Because there are no snakes in New Zealand, there are no large lizards, and we narrowed this down to possibly very large freshwater eels. And in the end, I didn't use a fishing rod there. I just smeared myself in fish guts and jumped in the water and waited to see what would turn up.
Right.
But I think you're right. You know, talking about sort of fishing shows generally, we try not to go the normal route. I tend to find most fishing shows sort of fairly boring myself. I watch them for information, but they're not necessarily entertaining, even if you're seeing large fish. In a way, I mean, we borrow a lot almost from the sort of, you know, detective story genre.
Yes.
Very often it starts with the story of somebody being attacked, maybe even killed by a fish. So it's almost, you know, there's a crime scene, there's a witness. I will talk to witnesses, I will talk to expert witnesses. Then I will assemble almost an identity parade of, you know, what could this have been? Could it have been a crocodile? Could it have been a python? Could it have been something else? Could it have just been the strength of the water itself? And then I will narrow it down to what I think is the likely, you know, the likely suspect. And then I will go and attempt to apprehend the suspect. And generally, the suspect doesn't want to come quietly. And then the final twist in the end, I will release the suspect, because it's not about, you know, it's not about punishment or whatever. It's about understanding what's going on.
Yeah, that's true. Or as we say in the U.S., the fish gets cuffed and stuffed, but then you let them go. So, I mean, and so it's not about punishing the fish, because this was not the fish in question. This would have been merely the type of fish that would have committed this particular crime.
Yeah, and like I say, very often it's again, you know, as in detective stories, there's the question of motive. So why did this happen?
And motive.
You know, very often it's somebody being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and it's not. For example, there are stories of alligator gar grabbing people's feet. There's a famous story from the early 1900s of a young girl having a foot grabbed by something in the water in Lake Pontchartrain, and her brother hung onto her, and eventually her foot was released, but it was badly shredded by something. And that probably was an alligator gar, but it wasn't thinking, there's a little girl I want to eat. It saw some splashing in the margins of the lake. And back in those days, people didn't have running water in their houses. They would go down to the lakeside, the riverside, to clean their fish before eating them. And fish of all sizes would get used to finding little sort of scraps and tidbits in the water. And this would go right up the food chain. So I think, you know, that's what happened there. And it's probably just as much of a shock to the fish, you know, as it was to the girl to find, you know, for the fish to find that there was actually, you know, something a bit larger than it bargained for on the end of what it thought was just a sort of little tasty morsel.
Well, I will get more into some of the usual suspects coming up in a few minutes. But let us go back a little bit and talk about you, because as the host of the show, I mean, people can look at you and they say, well, there's a you it's not like you just started fishing yesterday. You're a slightly older guy for what people usually see on a show like this. You're a guy with a lot of experience around the world. You can tell that. And you're also a guy who has this sort of, well, I said earlier, you were sort of a James Bond meets Babe Winkleman, but that's not a surprise. You actually got arrested once for being mistaken as a spy.
Right. That's one of the things that happened. And yes, I spent sort of over 25 years now traveling mostly solo, all sorts of places around the world, doing it self-funded, doing it on a small budget. And it's nice now to have a little bit sort of more comfort perhaps sometimes. But I mean, the great thing about just going and not having very much money is that you do tend to, well, you take your time and you really sort of immerse yourself in a place, and you have to do it the hard way. And one good thing about that, I've been writing for quite a long time as well, and in the course of doing that, finding the fish is my ultimate objective, but other things happen on the way, and very often things go wrong, you get into trouble. And I do find that I'm almost a sort of split personality in those circumstances, because there's part of me that's thinking this is a terrible thing to be happening. You know, why have I been arrested? What's all this about? And then there's the other part of me, which is the writer, thinking actually this is great material. Let's just
right.
keep this going.
Right. Yeah. Well, I don't mean anything by pointing out your age, except to say that on so much of television, it's almost like there's a ceiling that you have to be like under 28. I mean, new programs come up and so you stand out in that way as somebody who's got some real seasoning, some real experience, and you're a fresh face for us here in America anyway.
I suppose what I've done in a way has sort of kept me young. It's quite physical, so... I don't know. I'm possibly in better shape than I if I've been sort of sitting behind a desk all the time. Although I've caught various sort of tropical diseases along the way, which have acted in the other direction. And
and not many people have been hit by a fish that gave them a permanent heart problem. Is that true about that? That was that an Arapaima? How does that pronounce?
That was the Arapaima in the Amazon, which is said by many people to be the largest freshwater fish in the world. I was hit in the chest by one of these things. They got a very bony head. They will even kill each other by headbutting them each other like that. It turned out in the end, I did have a heart scan many years later, an MRI scan, and I was told when I went back for the results. I had been told by the cardiologist looking at me, he said, look, I'm 99%, you know, there's nothing wrong with you, but I'll send you for this scan. And when I went back, he was very apologetic, and he said, I have to tell you, there's something on the scan. And there were two areas of scarring to heart muscle. Now, heart muscle, unlike normal muscle, doesn't recover. It is permanent damage. So I had to have further tests, but actually... In the end, which I'm very happy about, that turned out to be an artifact. But I had many stressful weeks, sort of thinking back.
Right.
You know, what could it have been? Because normally you're talking about an automobile accident that causes that kind of damage.
Sure.
And I was thinking back, thinking what's possibly happened to me that could have caused that. You know, maybe I've had a slight heart attack or something like that. And the only thing that I could think about was this injury I had, which was so powerful. The bruising was so deep. I was still in pain 6 weeks later. I couldn't get out of bed properly after 6 weeks of this happening. So you know, that, it's not just fish that bite you; they can potentially damage you in other ways. And this particular fish, we were trying to net it. I was with some Anderson fishermen and a scientist, and whether it actually went for me or was just trying to escape, I don't know. But I was in the way, and it sent me flying, and I was still hurting 6 weeks afterwards.
How about that? Rammed by a fish. And how big was that particular? You said it was an Arapaima.
That fish would have been sort of 5 or 6 feet long, something like that, which is actually not particularly big for that species. You know, I've caught them getting on to 7 feet, and they grow possibly to 9 or 10 feet.
Well, but that is that the biggest fish you've ever caught? I thought you caught, didn't you catch a bull shark in one of those episodes?
I did, yes. I mean, the biggest fish that I've caught, I don't fish very much in the ocean. It's all fresh water. The biggest fish that I caught would have been around 500 pounds, slightly over 500 pounds. And you know, you're talking there about 10 foot long. And that was a bull shark. Now, a lot of people are going to think, well, hang on a minute, what's a bull shark doing in a river? But... bull sharks have a very interesting adaptation. Most sea fish can't survive in fresh water. They take on water and they burst literally. But bull sharks are able to make adjustments internally. And
well,
they do come into rivers, and you know, a lot of people don't know that. And you know, potentially you can fall foul of them, but that is actually a very complicated story as well, a very unexpected story, in fact.
Well, I want to get to that. I actually want to hear that story, and I want to see if we can't just check on your phone a little bit, too. Jeremy Wade, star of River Monsters, host of River Monsters, this great show on Animal Planet. Go take a look. We'll talk more about the Amazonian Nessie coming up here, too, which you can see that photo that Jeremy Wade took. We've linked that up at coasttocoastam.com, and the wolf fish and all of the other monsters he's yanked out of fresh water, coming up next on Coast to Coast. You know, I'm going to ask Jeremy Wade about any river monsters in the Mississippi. There got to be some giant catfish around there, like some of the ones he's found in other countries. But we're just getting started with Jeremy Wed. We'll talk about the Amazonian Nessie coming up too in just a moment. I was just about to tweet about him too. If you signed up for the Twitter account, I've got Deacon Punnett, DEACON, Deacon Punnett. Two N's, two T's. You can sign up at Twitter. And I send messages out throughout the week about what's coming up on Coast to Coast, what I'm reading, what I'm hearing about. And oftentimes, too, thank you. I often return those messages that you send me to on Facebook. So sign up there as well. And thanks for staying in touch with us. We'll get to your calls coming up later on in the show. If you missed the first hour, it's worth going back and listening to that. Tom Shadyac, the writer, director, producer of movies like Liar Liar, The Nutty Professor remake with kind of a reboot with Eddie Murphy, as well as Bruce Almighty and Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, and some of these other movies. He's doing a great job with that, but it was a great first hour. And if you missed it, go back and catch that at coasttocoastam.com. Just sign up for Coast Insider and go back and listen to any show you want and go into the future and listen to shows we haven't even done yet. It's kind of cool. It's a nice new feature of Coast Insider. Go find out more. And we'll get back to Jeremy Wade coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So Jeremy Wade had this, would you say, fairly normal upbringing in England. You were the son of a vicar. Is that what it says on your Wikipedia page?
That's true. Not everything on the Wikipedia page is totally reliable, but that bit is true, certainly.
and you were interested in fishing, just like any other normal kid was?
Yeah, the village where I grew up had a small river running through it, and nobody in my family fished, but I think it was something that parents did there. If they had boys rather than girls, they would give them a fishing rod, and it's a way of keeping them out of the house, but also hopefully out of trouble, because there were possibly other things I could have been doing at that time,
right.
And I happened to get hooked by fishing.
Yeah, well, you know, preacher's kids are notoriously making themselves familiar with the local gendarmes where I grew up. So PKs were always the troublemakers where I grew up. So no surprise there. But there's something about not just fishing, but this idea of getting really interested in the fish that you couldn't catch, or the fish that you were hearing about, or the fish that were in the depths of the water. How did that develop for you?
Well, I think fishing is always about you're never satisfied. You always want to get something bigger. There's always going to be something that maybe gets away, and you'll never know what it is, but you want to find out what it was. And You can get a sense of that even in your local river or pond, that there are things about the fish in there that people don't know, and you might be the first person to find out. How I ended up going around the world is a bit of a long story. I'll try and sort of summarize it very quickly. But what happened was that I think I almost, in the UK, I got fairly obsessed by fishing. I was in my teens. I was spending sometimes 2, 3, 4 days and nights at a stretch, camped by rivers and lakes. And at some stage, I realized that it wasn't the escape that it used to be for me. And the reason for that being that you know, England's a fairly small country. There's not much water. And these waters were getting crowded. The places I used to go to and have the lake to myself, there would be other people there. And it wasn't the same thing. And I gave up fishing. And I was a bit sort of at a loss what to do. And then a little while after that, I just quite by chance read an article in a magazine about somebody who'd been fishing in India. And I read that and I thought, well, this possibly offers what I'm looking for. And I bought myself the cheapest air ticket I could find to India, turned up there without a clue really what I was going to do. Stayed there for 3 months, caught some fish, wrote a couple of magazine articles after that, and then from there, I just sort of launched into this process of thinking, well, there must be other parts of the world, other strange fish that people don't really know about. I'll go and start looking for them.
Well, I love that, and thank you for doing that, so that we didn't have to, and that we could see what you've caught. In fact, one of the fish that you become famous for. At least I think that's one of the photos we put up at coasttocoastam.com is the Was it the giant devil catfish of India?
That's right, yes. Otherwise known as the Gooch. I mean, a lot of these things don't have English names, so giant devil catfish is something that it has been called. And this was the very first episode of River Monsters, and originally it was just going to be a one-off, and this was something that I heard about a few years before when I was there. I just heard this. I was actually making a series for Discovery Europe, and we heard stories about people in this one particular river, a tributary of the Ganges, disappearing, being pulled under. And again, it sounded quite hard to believe, but there were various possibilities. I mean, you get crocodiles in some parts of India, but this was, you know, the altitude was too high. It couldn't have been crocodiles. It couldn't have been pythons. You get bull sharks swimming a little way up the Ganges, but they couldn't have been here because they would have been rapids in the way. And then it got narrowed down to a species of catfish, which is a very strange looking, as well as a strange name. All catfish have tentacles on their mouths, but this fish has tentacles on other parts of its body. It has them trailing off its fins. I mean, it really looks like something from the imagination of Hieronymus Bosch or something like that.
Right.
And
yeah.
It's also got teeth. A lot of catfish don't have much in the way of teeth. This has very spiky teeth and a huge mouth. And there's quite a credibility gap also, because people are used to, again, we were talking earlier on about the sea. You expect monsters in the sea, man-eaters in the sea, possibly. We can believe that. But in fresh water, you know, is there anything for a start that's capable of growing that big? And also, just the behavior of anything in fresh water, does anything really, really do that? And so I also have a background as a scientist. I was a biology teacher for a while. And so, as well as just talking to people, I was approaching it from a sort of scientific point of view as well. How, you know, precisely how big would a fish need to be to be able to sort of engulf somebody, perhaps, or if not engulf somebody, grab them by the leg and pull them under. So I've tried to be sort of quantitative and scientific at the same time as getting people's stories. So there's a sort of a filtering process that goes on. I want to hear all these stories. I want people to tell me things, but I don't automatically believe everything they say. I then put it through a scientific filter. But you mentioned the Amazon Nessie earlier on. I mean, I have my own experience of seeing something strange and not being believed, and then being able to demonstrate that what I saw was in fact true. So I'm more sympathetic to stories such as these than other people might be.
Well, I'll get back to the Nessie thing, but just to wrap up on the giant devil catfish, then you go to find out whether or not this is possible, that there's a type of catfish that is strong enough and has the intent of pulling people under the water and either drowning them and or eating them. So what did you find?
Well, again, it's quite a complicated concept, the concept of a man-eater. You have fish that could potentially, you know, eat bits of a drowned corpse. And in other parts of the world, more than here, you get people just ending up in the water. There's also, you know, possibly some fish could actually pull somebody under and then dismember them. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got fish that could possibly engulf somebody. And this is a fish that does grow big enough. It could swallow somebody head first and leave just the lower part of their legs poking out. I did catch a very big one. The one that I caught, I don't think was a man-eater, but the one that I caught was 6 feet long, just over 160 pounds. And I had to jump into a raging monsoon swollen river in order to get the thing out. And the moment when I actually saw that remains one of my, you know, very vivid memories of the filming. It's very muddy water. There's something in there. And the, you know, the local Indian guy I was with grabbed hold of his tail, and this huge head sort of reared out of the water about 6 feet away from him. And then from that, I mean, the good thing about that is that I've got a fish that I can then weigh, I can then measure, and I can then think, right, okay, if this fish was say, even 30% longer, how big would its mouth be? And then, okay, would somebody fit down there potentially? Also, would it have the strength to pull somebody under?
I'd say yes, 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 and yes. After looking at the pictures, I say, okay, of course it could. But same thing too about the Goliath tiger fish. We linked up that photo at coasttocoastam.com, and that is not only ginormous, but I mean the jaws and the teeth on that. It's not a shark, but it looked like it could take off a leg pretty easily.
Yes, I mean. That fish, I mean, it looks almost like something out of a science fiction book, or it looks more like a piece of engineering than a fish, almost, or certainly
right.
It does. And it's almost like a bear trap, one of those spring-loaded
right.
traps. And
perfect.
It is in fact related to the piranha. Now, people get very excited about piranhas and have nightmares about them, but the piranhas don't grow much more than a few inches long. This is something that grows 6 feet long, possibly more, and that mouth is a complete scaled up scale model of what you've got in the piranha. So what this fish does, it doesn't swallow stuff; it just bites a clean lump out, and the teeth interlock a bit like scissor blades, so it's a very, very clean lump. And in the Congo, I've heard of there was a woman I saw who'd been washing dishes in the river, and one of these things took a lump out of the back of her leg and actually severed her Achilles tendon. So you're talking there, permanent disability.
Sure.
One thing that the locals say, I wasn't able to verify it, but they do say that if you're a man swimming without any clothes, this is a fish that likes to snack on whatever
your genitals
dangling down. So be very careful to wear
Ow.
To wear underwear at least.
Yes.
So the thing about it is, again, if you hear about that fish, when I first went after it, which was actually in the early 80s, I couldn't find any published pictures anywhere. There were a couple of stories in books, and you think, how can this be? This is a huge scaled up piranha. The outside world doesn't really know anything about it, and part of the reason for that is that it only lives in the central region of the Congo, which is to this day one of the most inaccessible regions in the world, and nobody really goes there as a tourist. Nobody in their right mind goes there at all who doesn't live there. So just the challenges of getting into that part of the world before you even get a line in the water. I went there twice and caught nothing before I eventually caught something. And so, I mean, I was never really a traveler, but the desire to see and find these fish has sort of turned me into a bit of an expert in tropical rainforest travel and
sure.
all the rest of it along the way.
Extreme travel, extreme fishing. I mean, you've got everything you're going to do is going to fall into that category. And as you said before, it took you two trips to get that, and then you finally actually catch one. And that does parallel what a lot of cryptozoologists go through, is that sense of not being believed. They say there's a species. I mean, it's sort of like even the idea of a lowland gorilla, which for years they thought, oh, that's just a myth. And then of course, now they catch one, and now there's lowland gorillas everywhere. But at one time, nobody believed it, and they believed it, they disbelieved it right up until the moment when somebody proved it. And that brings us back to your Nessie photo, so to speak, the one that you took in the Amazon of that, of what? I mean, we linked it up at coasttocoastam.com so people can see it, but what, tell us about that day that you took that photo, and what is in what we're looking at.
Okay. Well, actually, to rewind 1 year before when I took the photograph, I was paddling around in a small wooden canoe on this Amazon lake, and I was looking for arapaima, this large freshwater fish that I mentioned earlier, supposedly the biggest freshwater fish in the world. And various things were rippling the surface, but because the water's muddy, I can't really see much. And so I'm looking, and something broke the surface, and it just seemed to have this very strange profile, almost like a dragon's crest, a row of large points, a bit like a saw blade, something like that. And I did a sort of a, I cross-referenced in my sort of mental data banks, you know, what on earth is there that's maybe sort of 9 or 10 foot long and looks like that? Well, nothing. And I had a word with this Amazon fisherman whose hut I was staying in and told him what I'd seen. And this is someone who knows the lake very well. He said, well, there's nothing like that that lives there. And I mentioned it to other people out there. And supposedly, you know, you listen to scientists who research in the Amazon, you know, and Amazon fishermen will believe anything, they'll tell you anything, you know. But these people were genuinely puzzled and disbelieving and actually said I was making it up. I was then back there a year later, and I'm on the same lake, and I'm fishing, and the fishing's not going very well, and some Amazon pink dolphins started rolling around me. And I didn't have any pictures of pink dolphins, so I thought, I'll try and get some pictures of these. Now, when you can't see through the surface, you're literally just waiting for something to appear momentarily, and then you try and snap it. Very, very, very hard thing to do. So I got through a couple of films trying to shoot these things. Wasn't particularly clear what I'd got. This was back in the days of film or slide film before digital photography. So I had to wait several weeks. I was back in England, processed the film, various pictures of the sky and tilted horizons and anonymous looking splashes in the water. A couple of dolphins. The pink dolphins are actually quite common in the Amazon if you go to the right areas. But then I had two perfect sharp frames of the thing that I'd seen. Normally when you get pictures of something like that, it's blurred, you look at it, is that really what, you can sort of interpret it any way you like. But these were two very, very clear frames. So I'm then on to various people here, you know, what could this be? There was some thought it might be some new species. But aside from all that, the thing that it really said to me was that to do with the nature of perception. We all think we know what we see, but in fact, between what we see and what happens in our brain, it goes through a filter of you know, what we believe and our model of the world. And what has happened to me, and I think what happens to a lot of people, is they see something, and if you're then met with disbelief, you tend to almost believe yourself that my eyes must have been playing tricks. So you can almost censor it. You know, either I'm losing it a little bit, or maybe I should just forget about that. Maybe it didn't happen. And the fact that I actually photographed it proved to me that I wasn't imagining it. And that's why, as I said, I have more time for people nowadays who tell me about things that are generally not believed. And I think you mentioned about a lot of things which aren't believed until there's proof. That there is, scientists rightly want proof of things, but the position seems to be that if you've got no photograph or whatever, then it doesn't exist.
Right.
But a lot of people in these parts of the world, they don't carry cameras. You're just going on their word. And the thing about fishermen, you know, as well as spending a lot of time on the water, fishermen look very, very closely at the water and can see things that other people can't. When I first went to the Amazon, even though I was used to spotting fish, the patterns of ripples and things that you see are different. They're different for different animals. And it took me a long time to tune in and to be able to see what Amazon fishermen are seeing. Even if you're talking normal everyday fish, someone would point to me and say, look, you know, there's an arapaima. It's about the length of this canoe. And I'd look and I'd see the ripples in the water, but I wouldn't see the fish at all. I think, how is that different from, you know, the caiman, the alligator that surfaced a couple of minutes ago or whatever. So
right.
These are people looking very, very closely at the water. And if they tell me they've seen something unusual, I won't automatically accept what they say, but I'll sort of give them a certain amount of benefit of the doubt.
Well, hang on, because I want to get back to then the conclusion. Then what do we know from the photographs? As we link them up at coasttocoastam.com, you can go take a look. Jeremy Wade from River Monsters took two photos of what looks like an Amazonian Nessie. So what do we, to this day, what do we know? What do the scientists tell him? And I just got to revisit that idea of how much time he spends chasing after these river monsters in a canoe next on Coast to Coast.